Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Homelessness is on the forefront of California's consciousness, a crisis only exacerbated during the pandemic. Today on Insight, Sacramento City Mayor Daryl Steinberg is pushing for a bold proposal, what could become a first-in-the-nation right to housing for those living outdoors. But tied to that right, a legal obligation to accept housing when offered. Mayor Steinberg made the announcement during his State of the City address, and there are still a good amount of details to flesh out, not to mention approval from the City Council. But this latest strategy to care for those living outdoors also comes with its share of criticism. Mayor Daryl Steinberg joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me, Vicky. Good to be with you.
Well, Mayor Steinberg, you have long been a leading Democratic voice in responding to homelessness across the state, dating back to the state legislature. You co-chaired Governor Newsom's Homeless Advisor Council last year. The issue is worsening, despite relief initiatives growing. Why is a right to housing and an obligation to accept that right the right next step?
First of all, I think it is important to acknowledge that both statewide and in the city and county, we've actually made some progress, even though the appearances and the reality are in some ways worse. Look, over the last 4.5 years, the city and county have gotten 13,449 unsheltered homeless people into permanent housing. And that is significant. And yet the problem grows for a variety of reasons. High housing costs, mental health, substance abuse, poverty, just the increased fragility of people living, in precarious circumstances. And so I look at this and I say that while we're doing a lot, we have to do much more. And in Sacramento, we're preparing a master siting plan to be able to accommodate 5,000 new people. We have more money than we've ever had before. What is missing? In my opinion, what is missing is the fundamental reality that everything that government does when it comes to housing and homelessness is optional and voluntary. And I think the results speak for themselves. For some jurisdictions do a lot, some do very little. There's no requirement that jurisdictions pool their resources or that there be a regional approach. We know that local control sometimes goes too far, where jurisdictions can say no to more affordable housing. We know there's a lot of regulations in the way. And so I believe that when something is this important in society, we ought to require it. Think about other major issues of public import. We don't say that providing a free public education to children is optional. We require it. Climate change is imperative. We don't say replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy is an option. We require it. When it comes to people with developmental disabilities, we don't say that providing care to them is optional. We require it. Why, when it comes to this problem of homelessness, unsheltered homelessness, and the numbers of people who are living out on the streets with severe mental illness and are substance abuse, is everything that government at all levels is called upon to do optional or voluntary? I believe that housing and treatment for people who are ill is important enough that it ought to be not just a moral right, but a legal right as well. And in my opinion, until we acknowledge that housing people and caring for them is as important as any other fundamental right in society and make it a legal right, that we will make progress, we'll help a lot of people, but the essence of the problem will not fundamentally change. That's why I'm pushing so hard to say there ought to be a legal right to housing and shelter in the capital city of Sacramento.
You also mentioned that when it comes to enforcement for refusing housing when offered, if this does move forward, it would be civil, it would not be criminal. But Bob Erlenbush with the Sacramento Regional Coalition to End Homelessness, he's quoted as saying, civil action doesn't make a lot of sense to a person who's unhoused in our community, doesn't have any money. How will penalize those living outdoors lead to a reduction in the unhoused population?
So what you're speaking about, first of all, there's two parts to my proposal, as you said in your introduction. First is a fundamental right to housing. The second part of my proposal is to say that when people are offered housing or shelter that is safe and dignified, that they should have the responsibility to take it. And really what I am saying here, you know, sometimes we take the most complicated issues, and this is complicated, and the complex nature obscures some basic truths. We ought to have a fundamental policy in our society that people live indoors. And we ought to be driving towards that. Look, people who live on the streets unsheltered live on average 25 years less than people who live indoors. Dying on the streets is not is a terrible thing. Dying on the streets is not something that has anything to do with a person's liberty. In fact, just the opposite. And so what I am saying is here, let's state the public policy. Let's first enforce it on government to create enough capacity to be able to actually offer somebody a safe place to live. And then once we have met that obligation, to say to the individual that you have to come inside. Now, we should never criminalize homelessness. And when I talk about civil action, you know what I'm really saying? What I'm really saying is that you can't camp out in one of the disparate tent encampments that exists all over the city and the county. That's all I'm saying, is that there ought to be a push and a requirement if you're offered to come either indoors or to one of our newly constituted safe ground, outdoor tiny home tent encampments, where at least they're organized in such a way that we can bring the social workers and the mental health workers to come on in and help people in their homelessness. I believe most people want to come inside. Who would want to live out in the freezing cold or in the heat of a Sacramento summer? So the obligation is first on government. But really what I'm saying here is that the policy of our city should be that people live indoors. We ought to require it legally. And when we do so, we will save lives. We will help so many people. And we will achieve a cleaner and a safer city for all the people of Sacramento.
You know, there's also discussion when you're talking about the issues surrounding those experiencing homelessness, you know, the dignity of the individual. But you also talked about when proposing this right to housing that at times the pendulum sometimes swings too far in one direction. Can you unpack what you meant by that?
So what I meant by this, as you know, I mean, most people know that I've had a lifelong passion for improving California's mental health system. I authored the Millionaire's Tax in California, Proposition 63, generates $2.5 billion a year for mental health services. And I have always believed that voluntary services are the coin of the realm. Because when you build trust with somebody who is ill and maybe been traumatized, who doesn't trust the system, you have a much better chance to help them. But when I say the pendulum has swung too far, the community mental health movement was in response to the closure of the state mental hospitals back in the 1970s and 80s. That was the right policy, because One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest may have been a fictional movie, but there was a lot of truth to it. Those were not good places for people to live. And the civil rights of people living with mental illness were affected in profound ways. And so we said, let people live in the community, but let's fund the programs that would allow people to live with independence and dignity. And despite Prop 63, the funding has never kept up. I praise Governor Newsom and the legislature, because now they've put more money now into mental health than ever before. But the pendulum, we never want to go back to state hospitals, ever. But at the same time, there is no liberty in somebody with severe mental illness living unsheltered on the streets. There is no liberty in dying on the streets. And so my call for saying there ought to be a right to housing and an obligation to take it if offered is also an attempt, yes, to swing that pendulum a little bit back towards the middle, where we say, as a matter of public policy, nobody lives outdoors. And what a right to housing will do, and an obligation to come indoors will do, it will light a fire under all of the systems, all the cities, all the counties, the state of California, to do even more, to make sure that we have more efficiency housing, more manufactured housing, more tiny homes, more safe, organized campgrounds, more permanent housing, more of what people need, instead of the sort of patchwork system that we have now that, yes, helps a lot of people, but isn't driving us towards the scale that I believe Californians and Sacramentans so desperately want and are rightfully demanding.
Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me, Vicki.
Up next, a campfire survivor shares the long road to recovery and offers advice as we grapple with another destructive wildfire season. Plus, California's 2020 wildfire season set a record for the most acres burned. So why did FEMA reject the vast majority of emergency aid applicants? An NPR investigation has some answers. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. This week, we at Cap Radio asked listeners across the state their most pressing questions amid yet another ominous wildfire season. That special, California Wildfires, Your Questions Answered, will air Thursday at 9 a.m. in place of Insight. I'll be hosting alongside reporters at NPR stations statewide, as well as have experts in the field of climatology and infrastructure. Last week, I took a trip to Paradise to share the long road of recovery for those rebuilding following the 2018 Camp Fire, the deadliest wildfire in state history, consuming the towns of Paradise, Magalia, Concal, Polga, among others. I spent the morning with wildfire survivor Stephen Murray, who, like tens of thousands of others, lost their home and job, but most importantly, their sense of community and belonging. In the 2.5 years since, Stephen is still rebuilding his home in Paradise. He's gotten married. He became a father. He also created the nonprofit Coral Apple Foundation, helping thousands of campfire survivors to this very day. We caught up on how Paradise is rebuilding and growing, but also the healing that is still taking place and the challenges that remain.
Hello, my name's Stephen Murray. I live here in Paradise, and I've been up here for 35 years.
How long did it take you to return to Paradise?
Yeah, so I just got back. I got back on putting dates together, right? A lot of people call it the campfire brain. You just kind of lost, you know, in it all. I moved back to Paradise in March 1st. I moved back to Paradise with my family, my wife, and two kids.
Does it feel the same or does it feel different?
It feels different. You know, I was laying in bed last night in our house, and I literally was like, this is a blessing to have a new home, but I just want my old house back, you know? So there's still a lot of emotions that run through my mind and my daily routine, because it's never gonna be the same. It's a different world we live in. And it's tough.
How many people are here in Paradise, you know, compared to before the campfire?
Yeah, you know, there was 26,000 people that left that day. And right now, I want to say there's 2,900 people.
When you're talking to your neighbors or going into town talking to those 2,900 people, I guess, how does everyone feel if you can kind of tap into that community sentiment?
You know, a lot of people are struggling still, if it's with building cost or getting a loan or even employment. You know, right now, if you're not in the construction field, it's hard to work in Paradise. So right now, most of the homes that are going in are remanufactured homes. It's real easy to level your lot, bring in some gravel, and put a home on there. But right now, it's about a year's wait to, if you want to order a home and have it delivered, it's about a year out. So the, you know, the cost of building, I talked to my mortgage company, loan company today, and $300 a square foot is basically what the square footage of a home is being rebuilt up here. And I did an owner builder, so my house didn't cost that much, but still battling. Employment is tough up here in Paradise. And so, yeah, just going through the motions. Mm-hmm. But as we know from the campfire in 2018, that we lost water too. So that water's a big issue. Right now we're in the middle of a drought. So I'm dealing with the local water district to get a new meter put on my property. As one of the stipulations of rebuilding is you have to have a new water meter. And so the whole town is still under construction with water meters and laterals of water. So we're still going through that.
Remind all of us about the water situation. What happened?
Yeah, so what happened is the water sat in the metal pipes for so long. I want to say it's benzene sat in the pipes. And basically just until yesterday or the day before, I got a notice from the water district saying it's okay to drink the water here. So, but it's still one of those things where there, you can see stuff coming through my pipes. It's clogging the little screens and the faucets in my home and little part polycules of metal are still coming through my pipes, you know, so it's tough. There's a lot of people up here that do not believe that the water is okay, and you can get your personal water test done. You could take it to the water district or to Chico and have your water tested, but it's something that's always going to be in our minds, that is our water safe, you know. We take that for granted, and we don't think, hey, is our water safe to drink? But as a campfire survivor or somewhere that the water's been disrupted, you know, you question it.
When you go back to November of 2018 in that morning and you help over 100 people be rescued, you save their lives. How do you reflect on that day?
I do reflect on November 8th, 2018, because I made a decision to go to work. I did. I worked at a senior mobile home park where there's 281 seniors. And I think about what would have happened if I wasn't there. And I wouldn't. There's days I regret not grabbing things from my own home and just taking off to go to work and sending my family out of the fire. And I decided to go back to work that morning for 2.5 hours, kicking in doors, breaking through the fence to get us out the back and putting my life on the line.
Do you look at the past, you know, more than 2.5 years as kind of chapters of or steps moving forward? And I guess, how do you describe where you're at now compared to when you effectively lost everything and you moved to like a half dozen places, and now you're building a home back in Paradise. What does today or this point in your life feel like?
I feel very blessed. You know, I did a home birth here with my family May 30th. Beautiful little girl. I got a 2-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a wife. Being back in Paradise is a huge thing, you know, and as much as I wanted to pack up and just say, you know what, forget it, I can't do it, yeah, I had to be strong, and every day that I pounded those nails or I put up my walls in my home, it's a huge undertaking to be able to afford to rebuild in a town like this. For one, what if a fire comes here again? You know, you have that fear. Just learning, you know, about other PTSDs that I have, not realizing that the morning of the fire, I kicked in doors, and I just learned when I went to a friend's house, I knocked on the door, they didn't answer, and I thought first thing was, if they don't call me, I'm going to have to kick their door in. And I didn't realize that was a huge problem just until this last month, that it is something that I do have a problem with. And it's something I'll overcome. It's just I didn't know until it happened, like right, if a fire were to hit, you know, if another fire were to come. It's having your go bag. It's what do you want to take and not lose this time? And so we think about all those things that now, right? Are we insured? What are we going to take when the fire, if a fire does come, what safety do we have? Just last night I was laying there holding my daughter's hand. She's 2.5, and you always want to give the best to your kids, you know? And I sat there last night going, man, like tomorrow, if I had to explain to my daughter the situation that we're really in, that's heartbreaking, you know? I hold a lot on my shoulders. And
you're just talking about, you know, more than 2.5 years of obstacles and challenges and detours. I would imagine you are not the only one who's alone in this when it comes to other people who survived the campfire and are choosing to rebuild here in Paradise.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people that I see are rebuilding up here after the campfire is that they don't have no neighbors. That, yes, they have a brand new home, but they don't have any shade. They don't have any trees because they all burnt down or they all died. It's a, don't get me wrong, I almost, you know, last week I almost just wanted to just load up my truck and leave because there's a point where you just can't take no more. And yes, we've made this decision to stay. Yes, we've put our own selves and family in these situations, but I don't know. It's I'm going to live in this town forever. You know, my kids will be raised here and they've got a lot of memories to talk about, you know, to their grandkids and their children. But this is it's a tough time for everybody. But if you've lived and you've lost everything in a fire, and but yet you deal with PTSD and you're trying to rebuild, there's a lot of people that need help. And just because a fire happened 2.5 years ago doesn't mean that we're okay, you know. A lot of the resources have gone away to other fires, and we get that. But like just today, somebody donated a kitchen table to us. And so there's a lot of people that care out there, and it feels good to know that you're cared about, you know, that some people haven't forgot you.
So let's talk about Coral Apple Foundation. For listeners who haven't heard about the Coral Apple Foundation, how it started, how many people you've helped, and where it's at now.
Yeah, April of 2019, I started Coral Apple. Coral Apple came, I lived on Coral Avenue, and I worked at Apple Tree Village, so my wife came up with Coral Apple. And we have been helping people all over the place. We helped about 86 families with trailers, relocating them. In 2019, I drove over 100,000 miles, taking people from Arkansas to Montana, Wyoming, every surrounding state. We've done events, helping thousands of folks with propane, gas, clothes, food. And till this day, I'm still helping out. And it's not just Paradise. It was Concow, it was Cherokee, it was Magalia, Honey Run.
2021, what's the need now when people call you for help and call Coral Apple Foundation for help?
Yeah, right now, at this present time, a lot of seniors need help. A lot of seniors.
You mean like assisted living or help with medical issues and things like that?
Yeah, I know that there's only one senior living place up here. They only have 12 beds. Chico is just full. And so a lot of people are in Sacramento, Yuba City area, and they want to be closer to home. Well, closer to home these days for campfire survivors is all over the world, all over the United States. And people are just scattered everywhere. So I am finding out that a lot of people are reaching out that, hey, we want to get mom closer to home. Is there a way that you can help with this? And what I mean by this is it's electric wheelchair, or, hey, I'm moving my mom in and she's 75 years old on a walker and she needs a ramp built. It's those resources that are, it's not just material, it's somebody that has the time to build a ramp for a senior. And so those are things that I do.
It's projected to be another really strong wildfire season. We have over 1,000 more fires than we've had the same time last year. And last year, there was a North Complex fire, which was in this area in Butte County. What do you want people to know who the reality is there are going to be some wildfires or more wildfires this summer? If they become a survivor, what would you like them to know as they embark on this really long road of rebuilding and kind of figuring out what the next chapter in their lives are?
There are going to be a lot of wildland fires coming up. And when you leave your home, you have to have the mindset that it will be gone or it can be gone when you get back, and to prepare yourself financially, prepare yourself emotionally, that there's a lot of stubborn people out there that haven't asked for help. And there's a lot of people that have stressed themselves to the point of death. As a campfire survivor myself, 2.5 years later, I'm still not emotionally over it. And unfortunately, the whole town burnt down, you know? And you do have 26,000 people that have scattered and 2,900 have come back. But those 2,900 people that are back aren't okay. Fire does a lot of damage. And that is mentally and physically. A lot of people lost their 85 people lost their lives that day. And a lot of people have passed since due to the fire stress. There's times where I sit there and go, you know what? I'm seeing a heart doctor right now because I have breathing problems from the fire. You know, all I can say is if you ever burn out from a campfire is to, like I say, find resources. They're out there. You have to search. You just can't. A lot of people think that they're not there. And if you go out and you find help, it's there. I want to thank all the churches, the Community of Paradise, and all Red Cross, you know, FEMA helped, the Small Business Association, SBA. They helped my family out. So I just want to thank everybody out there that's helped the campfire in 2018, because until this day, we're still receiving help from people. You know, it's been a blessing to have the help from my family.
Looking ahead, maybe 10, 20 years from now, when your kids are adults living here in Paradise, what do you want them to see and how do you want it to feel? What do you envision for Paradise as someone who loves it and doesn't see any other place as your home?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because you just want people to see the beauty in things, you know, not the bad. Some people just see the bad. There's no trees, there's no neighbors, there's no, the roads are terrible. But in 20 years, you're going to have the good roads. The trees will be back. You can go 9 miles up the road, and it's like there was no fire hit there. So there are surrounding areas that are still nice, you know. It's, everything will be fine. You know, it's, once my house is done and I can take a deep breath of fresh air up here, it will, it's all rewarding.
That is campfire survivor Stephen Murray, currently rebuilding his home in Paradise. Stephen is also the founder of the Coral Apple Foundation, created after the campfire, helping survivors to this very day. CAP Radio's statewide special, California Wildfires, Your Questions Answered, will air Thursday at 9 a.m. in place of Insight. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. California's 2020 wildfire season set a record for the most acres burned in state history. Nearly 10,000 fires burned over 4.2 million acres. That's more than 4% of the state. The August complex fire's destruction was larger than the state of Rhode Island. So you can just imagine the amount of emergency aid that could follow. But an NPR investigation discovered a lesser-known record-setting statistic. Just 5% who applied to the Federal Emergency Management Agency for help received any financial assistance. 95% of claims were rejected. That is the lowest eligibility rate for FEMA aid of any U.S. wildfire disaster on record. That investigation was led by data journalist Sean McMinn. Sean joins us now with more on his findings. Welcome to Insight, Sean.
Hi, Vicki. Thank you for having me.
Well, Sean, I just basic question first. How is it supposed to work when someone survives a wildfire?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And like your last guest said, it can be a confusing, it can be a traumatic time. One of the first things that someone who survives or escapes a wildfire is encouraged to do is to apply to FEMA. You submit, you know, the information about your property, your personal information, any insurance that you had. And FEMA is supposed to cover what they call uninsured losses, basically things like housing, rent, transportation that weren't paid for by your insurance. And as of last year, it could be up to about $70,000 of assistance. You can apply at one of those disaster resource centers where they bring in a bunch of different agencies. They set up tables in like a gym or something, or online or through the phone, or they even have a mobile app now.
What are some of the reasons outside of a structure being burned that a resident would qualify for that assistance?
Yep. So it won't surprise you that number one reason that you would qualify after a fire is, of course, if your home is burned. But if, let's say, smoke surrounds your home and it becomes uninhabitable because of that. That could be another reason. The winds that are kicked up from a fire is another reason that FEMA will recognize. But most of it's going to come from burn damage.
Well, the most recent California wildfire disaster, it hit a record for the lowest FEMA approval rate in wildfire history. You led that investigation. Why was that? What happened?
That is a very good question. And that is a big question that we were trying to answer. And what's funny is that we got different answers from different people we talked to, and none of them quite explained it. And I'll give you an example. So initially, FEMA said that perhaps the people who were being denied were people who had evacuated and didn't know whether or not their home was damaged. It turns out their home was not damaged, and so, of course, they were not eligible, and therefore they were denied. But we later found out that those people actually wouldn't have been counted in these numbers at all, that denial rate is only of people who indicated that they had damage. Now, a possible explanation is an issue that we know FEMA is dealing with right now, and that's an increase in people who are submitting fraudulent applications. Sometimes they don't even live in the state, let alone the area that burned, but they're just trying to, make a buck off this government program.
Fraud, it would be potentially a huge issue. When you talk to FEMA, what do they have to say about the potential that a vast majority of this were fraudulent applications?
Yeah, so we put this question to them, and at first we were told that there was no overall count yet for the suspected number of fraudulent applications in California. This was, well after the wildfire. We're talking about reporting that we did this spring. We later have gotten some figures for specific counties we asked for, but we still don't have a full accounting of how many suspected fraudulent applications there were for the California wildfires last year.
When looking at the counties that you looked into in California, some of the numbers are just egregious. I mean, can you just run through some of the counties you looked at in terms of, the number of applications and the ones that were actually approved?
Yeah, so let's start with San Mateo County. That's up north in the Bay, of course. There last year, according to CAL FIRE, there were fewer than 20 homes that were burned. But there were 1,500 people who indicated that they had damage. Down south, San Bernardino County, 9 homes burned, about 650 applications to FEMA of people who indicated they had damage. And what's interesting, zooming in on San Bernardino, our member station reporter down there looked at where those applications came from. And a large number of them came from inside the city of San Bernardino itself. Well, the fire did not burn the city of San Bernardino. And in fact, some of the awards that were given were in zip codes that FEMA publishes the information for, in zip codes that were 30 miles away from the fire, on the other side of a mountain. So we haven't gotten an explanation for how that could be possible. Of course, some reasons for that could be fraud, which we talked about before, but there's also an element of confusion in all this, right? I mentioned before, you evacuate, you don't know whether your home is destroyed or not. Perhaps your neighbor's home was burned, and so you assume yours is. You submit an application to FEMA indicating, that you lost your home, and then it turns out that it wasn't actually lost. So, I mean, this whole process was a theme we found in our reporting, this confusion both, of course, among survivors, but also within FEMA and the communications back and forth between the two.
Is this something that's unique to California, or is this happening elsewhere?
That's a very good question, and that's actually how we started on this whole reporting thread. A reporter in Jefferson Public Radio in Southern Oregon, her name is April Ehrlich, she started looking into the similarly low acceptance rate last year after Oregon's record-setting wildfires. And she was able to get some internal documents that showed that of the 21,000 applications for assistance after those fires, 9,000, roughly half, were suspected of being fraudulent. So obviously that's a pretty big proportion up there. Again, we don't know if that was similarly happening in California, despite the fact that the fires were at the same time and relatively similar in size and scope. What we do know is that a congressional committee sent a letter to FEMA a few months ago where they were asking some questions about these low denial rates. And in that letter, they cited a statistic that there was 130,000 suspected fraudulent applications nationwide over the last 18 months. So this is clearly a problem, not just in Oregon, although that's one place where we found it, but in other parts of the country too. We just don't know at this point how that pertains to last year's California wildfires.
Right. And you also bring up a good point that there's also, it's a confusing process when you deal with the trauma of a wildfire. But if fraud is even partly to blame, this is a hit to taxpayers, but there are other concerns. How does this ultimately undermine the process for actual wildfire victims?
That's right. Of course, there is the concern about people who are profiting off the system, you know, potentially illegally, and that's obviously a crime you can go to jail for. But there's also the concern of what does this do for the rest of the people who are applying, the legitimate, let's say, survivors. I mean, at its most obvious level, right, this is a large number of applications coming in. In Oregon, we're talking about, 9,000 out of 21,000 that were suspected fraudulent. And that's going to slow down the process just because there's a limited number of resources at FEMA to process all those. But at the same time, we found that the steps that FEMA takes to try to screen out the fraudulent applications sometimes end up actually screening out real survivors. We talked to a couple in Oregon where they submitted the husband's social security number to FEMA. They lost their home in one of the fires there last year. And the agency said the social security number didn't match what was in their databases, so they denied them aid. For the 9 or 10 months after the fire, they hadn't received anything from FEMA because of that, you know, that screening mechanism. And once their story published last week, they did receive a letter from FEMA that was telling them that they would get aid. But it wasn't until then that FEMA knew about it. There wasn't, you know, a hard count of how many times this thing happened, right? Because FEMA is trying to screen out the good from the bad, so to speak. But we did get some documents from FEMA through a Freedom of Information Act request where they surveyed roughly 4,000 people who had gone through the process last year. And we saw this happen over and over again, dozens of times, people who said, you know, FEMA told me that I don't live at this address and I've lived here almost my entire life, or FEMA couldn't verify my identity, so I didn't get any aid. So it appears that these things that are designed to prevent fraud are really sometimes catching people who truly went through a disaster.
Mm-hmm. You know, finally, in just the last 20 seconds or so that we have, are there any other big questions that you're still looking into?
Yeah, no, and I'm really glad you asked that. We have a team of NPR member station reporters across the state still looking into how this, you know, process played out last year, but then also looking at what's going to happen this year, right? As you mentioned a minute ago, California is set for potentially another terrible wildfire year, and our reporters will be monitoring that. If anyone listening, feels like they have information to add, they should absolutely get in touch with you.
Sean McMinn is a data journalist, and thank you so much for sharing your work and your investigation with Insight.
Thanks, Vicki.
Still ahead, a local teacher shares her rare journey with NASA, soaring 43,000 feet high into the Earth's stratosphere. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome Welcome back to Inside on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A teacher from Sacramento embarked on an extraordinary opportunity, soaring to the Earth's stratosphere on a NASA mission. Domina Stamus is a science teacher at the new Westlake Charter High School in Natomas. She previously taught at Sacramento High and was among just 28 STEM teachers from across the country selected as an Airborne Astronomy Ambassador for SOFIA. SOFIA is an acronym for Stratosphere Observatory for Infrared Astronomy. The SOFIA telescope allows scientists to make discoveries within our solar system that previously was impossible. The program takes teachers along for the journey and provides each with curriculum and supplies so they in return can teach astronomy to their students. I caught up with Domina over coffee yesterday about her rare journey and how it will expand students' horizons about what's possible. How do you reflect on your opportunity with NASA, now safely back on, 2 feet firmly planted on ground?
It was definitely a once-in-a-lifetime and very honored thing that I got to do. I love talking to people about it. They get super excited. Just knowing someone was able to go that high up into the atmosphere. It also has inspired me to inspire my students, you know, so it just really motivated me and it gave me a sense of new found perspective on just life in general. You know, our planet is the only one that has life. And I've said this multiple times, like I just wish people just knew how unique and precious this planet is, and I just feel like if people look down more on it and often, they could appreciate it a little bit more. So, and I know I have. So,
I mean, this was just such an epic opportunity. How did this begin for you? How did you find out about it?
Yeah, so I found out about the SOFIA telescope by talking with a coworker who actually worked on the telescope, and I was telling him I was, you know, in aviation, I fly planes too, and I also have a passion for astronomy. And so he told me about the SOFIA telescope, and I was like, wait, what? So I went and looked it up, and then I saw that there's this program called the Airborne Astronomy Ambassador Program for teachers. And I was like, this feels like it was meant for me, because I love planes, and I love aviation, I love space, and I applied for it. It's super competitive. There's several essays you have to write, and questions, all of that. And I waited for months, you know, to see if I was selected, and I was. So there were 28 of us that were selected for the 2020, they call it the Cycle 8 group of educators. And there's only been, in the total, I believe it's 10 years running now, but I believe there's only been 170 teachers that have flown within the 10 years that it's been flying.
When you found out that you were accepted, did the actual training surprise you? Was it what you expected?
Yeah, they actually lined everything out. They were really super prepared, super organized. There was no surprises other than COVID. But they did a very good job of telling us what to expect. We had to take a full astronomy course, so they paid for that, or it was, you know, free for us. So we took an astronomy course. We did training on learning about the telescope and all the different instruments. We learned the history of, so SOFIA isn't the only flying observatory. So there's a history behind planes flying for NASA and taking images. The higher you go up in the atmosphere, the more you get away from from water. And so it's easier to take infrared images. Water acts like a barrier when you're trying to view things through infrared. And so the higher you go up, you want to get a clearer picture. And so SOFIA and learning the history behind it, that was part of my training. And then when we got down to, and then we went to Vegas, and that's where we were trained on the curriculum around all of it. So it's a 10-day curriculum that I teach my students around the SOFIA telescope, infrared astronomy, and it's all standard-based, all based on the next generation standards. So it's not like, oh, we're just going to randomly teach you. No, these students actually need to know this for the for the state exam, for the CAST. So that's nice that they are mindful of that. You know, like, one, is it important for student learning? Two, is it important for, you know, reaching those science standards? And two, are they going to get something out of it in terms of, hey, this could be a potential career, you know? So, and then we went down there for the week after it was so fast. They were like, do you want to go? Are you ready to go? Because we weren't sure if we were ever going to go. They would ensure us that we would eventually go, but, you know.
Because of COVID?
Because of COVID, yeah. Finally they were like, okay, we're not quite sure, but can you go? And, you know, they selected a few of us were able to go right away. And it was such a fast, like, getting ready to do it. And we made it happen. And my group was the first. So there were three other educators from Alaska. So us four, we were the first, to go up, since 2019. So it was a very celebratory moment. One, for Sophia, because teachers are now back on the plane, and two, we were like the first after COVID, and, you know, all that stuff. So, yeah.
How high did you fly?
So we reached we were at 43,000 feet. So a typical airline will go somewhere between like 30, 35. So we were a little bit higher than most airlines. Yeah, and it was a large plane, you know. It's a 747 SP, specifically modified for that mission.
Was there anything physically that you had to prepare for, given that you're going several thousand feet higher than a normal airplane?
No, because no matter what, you could be in the best physical shape and altitude sickness will hit anybody. That hypoxia, that lack of oxygen. So the higher you go up, yes, you have less moisture, but you also have less oxygen. And so they just train you on symptoms of that, and you have to carry around this they call it a EPAC, EPAP, I remember, something like that. But it's because you're roaming around, you're not sitting, you're doing work. And so if there was a sudden change in pressure or oxygen, you have to have your stuff ready to go to put on your oxygen. I did have a little bit of a headache when I went up there, but I couldn't tell if it was because you fly from dusk till dawn, from sunset to sunrise. You're flying all night. And so I wasn't sure if I was getting a little bit of a headache because I wasn't used to being up at night, or if it was because of, you know, the altitude. But I took a little bit of Advil and I was fine, so.
Yeah. With that perspective, 45,000 feet up high, how does Earth look like? Did it feel different with,
yes,
all the way up there?
So what I did is I took pictures of the ground when I was on my Southwest flight, because I wanted to, like, compare, like, you know, how much different does it look? And it's definitely smaller. You definitely see, like, a horizon farther out than you would a regular flight. I got to see the moon rise when I was in the cockpit. I got to see the moon, like, I literally saw it from the horizon. It was this, like, red pinkish color. And then, like I'm trying to get video, but obviously it doesn't do it any justice, but it's rising and you're heading towards it. So we kind of chase the moon, and then we kind of come back and follow the moon of the way it moves, rises and sets. And it was just so cool to just see it rising. It was waning, which means the full moon was just a few days prior. So it was just a little bit shaded. So it was almost a full moon. But it just, like, chasing it and seeing it, and so bright and beautiful, and you're just like, wow, this is our planet. It does its own thing. Like, we have zero control over all of this motion. And we get to, like, participate in it and learn about it and discover things between it. So, yeah.
That sounds like a humbling experience.
Yeah, it definitely is. You're so small. And when you're, you know, we're looking down, and, you know, every once in a while we would fly over a big city. Like, I got some pictures from over Omaha, Nebraska. Sometimes Sophia flies over the Pacific Ocean. It flies in the southern hemisphere the parts of the year. So our mission was over the over in North America. So, yeah, and you just see how small those lights are, and you just realize there's humans down there that they're on the ground, and it's possible to be off the ground and looking beyond it. Yeah, it definitely is humbling.
And obviously a lifetime experience, and you went up there as a teacher. How is this going to change you and shape you as a teacher moving forward?
I actually really enjoyed talking to the team, the scientists, the telescope operators, the pilots, all of them, the safety tech, I think that's his title, but he was also a mechanic, and all of them, they all started with, I never thought I'd end up here. Everybody never thought I ended up here where I am. One of the telescope operators, she didn't even major in a science. And she just found herself at an observatory. Then she learned how to work a telescope. And then next thing you know, she's going here to here. And now she's, you know, working a telescope, the only flying telescope in the world. And to me, that's inspiring because I can bring those stories to my students. And this is in my, I have a vision that I have prepared, it changes every year, but one of the biggest things that I want my students to do is I want them to see themselves in the stories that I tell. And so if I can have more stories where they can relate to, or at least have an open mind about, I feel like I've done my job.
And that is it for Insight today. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.